Hello, and welcome to AMO Kenzaku, episode 56. We are a group of four Bubblegum Crisis Boomer otaku who talk about anime, manga, and other otaku-related subjects. The Kenzaku are...
Hey y'all, I'm Mike.
I'm Dylan.
I'm Sam.
And I am tonight's host, Nick. We are recording this episode on July 11th, 2024. And the topic is Nasubi, or maybe more of the documentary surrounding Nasubi called The Contestant. With that, Hashing. So before we actually dive into the documentary itself, I think maybe first we just go and give a very brief description of who Nasubi is and why he is a noteworthy individual. So, Nasubi is a Japanese comedian who is, I believe, now 48 years old. So he was an up-and-comer in the entertainment industry in the 90s, and he was selected to participate in a segment that was produced by Denpa Shonen, which was a very popular kind of sketch comedy variety show in Japan at the time. And they were very kind of becoming famous for having live or reality style segments that ran for, you know, long runs of time. I think the first one they did was having a couple of guys like circumnavigate on, or not circumnavigate, but like travel to like Singapore or something like that using like a pedal boat. Somebody can fact check me on that. It's something to that degree. So in essence, they were kind of pioneers in what we now would call reality TV, because they were doing this stuff starting in the mid-90s when, you know, it really wasn't much of a thing otherwise yet. But Nasubi was participating in a segment called, loosely translated, a Life in Prizes. And the concept was Nasubi would be in a barren apartment that only had magazines, postcards, a table, a pen, running electricity, water, and that's it. He was stripped of his clothing and had a cushion to cover his privates or to sit on. And he basically had to subsist on any prizes that he could win, entering by submitting postcards to particular competitions in the magazine. So for you youngins out there, back in the day, at least in Japan, it was very common to have contests where participants would send a postcard in with their name and address, and they would be picked lottery style, and the winner would win whatever particular prize it was. That was a relatively popular shtick in Japan during the 90s. And so the gimmick was that Nasubi would need to earn 1,000,000 yen worth of prizes before he was freed.
Just that's from like roughly $10,000.
Give or take, yeah. I think they call it about 8,000 USD on the in the documentary. And so, you know, that includes everything: food, clothing, entertainment, all of it. And the show became wildly, well, I shouldn't call it a show because it was a segment within a show, but that segment became wildly popular in Japan to the point where it was, I think they were saying something like 30 million people were watching every week for that one segment, and that was unheard of for a variety TV show. That's like the kind of numbers you see for like professional sports, you know, like headliner kind of matches, you know. Like,
because what population Japan was, what, about 130 million?
So, yeah, yeah, about 130 at that time.
So, yeah, that's like, that's a pretty decent Super Bowl, like, weekly.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it was a segment, and so it was a segment about a nude man who was basically generating content by himself. He was completely alone with a camera on him, which he knew the camera was on. And he also was, technically speaking, volunteered for this. The door was unlocked I'm stating facts here just because there's going to be plenty of opinions, I think, about this whole concept. And yeah, that was the concept of the show, was he basically needed to win 1 million yen worth of prizes, and then he won. But it turns out that that was actually just part one. Part two was he was then sent to Korea, where he then had to earn back his flight home to Japan by doing the same thing, but this time in Korea, which meant he had to learn Korean and do everything in Korean Hangul to earn the prizes, etc., etc. So the entire ordeal lasted, I believe, 15 months is what the documentary said, start to finish for him, which hindsight is a very long time to do something as monotonous as sitting, sitting naked at a table, filling in postcards and wondering when your next meal is going to come, right?
Yeah. And not so that's interacting with people really at all.
Exactly. So that's the background of the show, at the concept of the show. I think next I want to kind of get into our history with Nasubi, because all four of us pretty much saw the same Denpa Shonen kind of compilation special at the same time, probably within months of each other, if anything, because Sam, I believe this was Anime Expo circa maybe 2002? Somewhere around there, where it was still in the LA area. I believe it was in Anaheim. So everybody was crashing at my parents' house. Before that, you mentioned to me, hey, this is really wild show about this guy they keep lock up in a room and have him win everything by these contests by Denpa Shonen. I'm like, huh, interesting. And so we went to, while we were down in LA for AX, we went to my local Japanese video rental store, Video Jun, and lo and behold, they had them front and center, the two specials. So we rented those and watched them that weekend. I also bought a blank VHS and dubbed the tape, because this was gold to us, this kind of content. I mean, hindsight, it was fascinating to us, because quite literally there was literally nothing else like that in any sort of entertainment medium at the time. That concept, right? Like,
yeah,
it was a wild concept, and I mean, we watched it straight through and were having a grand old time watching it.
It was kind of like mind-blowing, right? Like, it was
right, we were in conniptions, like it was so unbelievable what they were capturing on TV. It was, you know, Japanese live television historically is pretty poor quality, not just in production value but also in concept. It's kind of just a lot of slapstick humor. And that's what Denpa Shonen was largely known for.
Yeah, I don't know if it's hard for me to know my feelings in the past, but my views now are that Japanese TV is generally pretty bad. But I've always felt that it had it was famous for the variety stuff, but I don't know if at that time I had that perception or not.
I feel like at that time there was the perception of Japanese TV as having cruel game shows. I can't remember what the Simpsons episode said in Japan was, where your game shows reward knowledge, ours punish ignorance, but was sometime in the late 90s, I feel
like. Yeah, and that hit definitely hits the nail on the head. I mean,
that's off of like, Takeshi's Castle?
Takeshi's Castle. The other very popular concept that was adapted from a Japanese kind of segment and wildly successful in the US as actually America's Funniest Home Videos, because that was a segment in a really old sketch comedy show called Kato-chan Ken-chan, and they always had that segment at the end where they would have funny videos submitted by viewers. And if you look at old episodes that were hosted by Bob Saget of America's Funniest Home Videos, at the very end of the credits it says inspired by Fun with Kato and Ken in the credits. So yeah, my parents were like, oh yeah, this isn't new, this is stuff that was old. And I realized, so I'm like, oh, you're right, I watched this 5 years prior on Kato-chan Ken-chan. So yeah, it's not a first time that Japanese television kind of inspired something that took off in the West. And I'm not going to suggest that Nasubi invented reality TV, but the concept of having a live camera on an individual 24/7 definitely did not really exist before Nasubi. I'm fairly confident.
Yeah.
In saying that.
I think the documentary say that? I think it does, right?
Yeah.
They certainly suggest it.
Yeah.
I think that it's a little bit too difficult to say with absolute, you know, decisiveness, but I think people can largely agree Nasubi was one of, at least one of the first.
Yeah, when was The Real World?
Real World...
That's true.
Oh. Real World started...
91, 2.
Yeah, Real World started in, like, 92. That might have actually been the first one, but it was kind of, like, isolated. I think kind of like the modern reality TV thing I was just kind of looking at. I think the first one that really blew up and then exploded out was in the U.S. was The Osbournes. And that was 2002.
And then Survivor getting big right around that. They all kind of went exploding out in that direction
starting around 2002.
Big Brother as well. Like, when you look at something that's more one-to-one with Nasubi, I think Big Brother is probably a closer facsimile.
Shoot, and wasn't U.S. Big Brother a remake already of a reality TV show from, I'm trying to remember if it was Sweden or some?
Yeah,
it was European, I believe.
Yeah, Sweden or UK or something.
Yeah.
And I guess that one, well, that one started in 2000. Wow, started earlier than I thought
so
it did.
It clearly was an idea that was going around, but Nasubi is the first show that I can really remember fully going there.
It's certainly the first, not to jump the shark too much, but it's certainly the first one where they also ended up having a simultaneous live web broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that was crazy.
A whopping 10 frames per second, whatever it was capable at the time with the technology. But we'll get into that segment, I think, when we get into the documentary. But so going back to, you know, our experience, so then Sam and I, obviously having, you know, now gotten entertainment gold in our hands with that tape, of course, loaned it to all of our buddies. Mike, I believe you then dubbed a copy of the dub that we had, because I think we showed it in a summer club. At least parts of it in the summer club thing. And
I couldn't remember if it was summer club or after hours, but I remembered that it was one of the few things that I remember watching in club, like, old school 80s style with, like, one of you up doing translations while we try and pause the wall of text so you could explain what was going on.
Right, because it was completely raw, of course. It was literally dubbed one-to-one from the retail version of the videotapes of the Denpa Shonen special that was aired. And then Dylan, I think around the same, probably the same time, it was also at some point passed to your hands. And for the next couple few years, and like Nasubi was a very well-known concept in the upper echelons of the club people, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his influence was clearly there in things outside of just Japanese variety TV, because he inspired anime characters to some extent. If you recall, in Infinite Revias, there was an unnamed character who was one of the kind of people that got stuck in the Revias, who quite literally, I remember asking the director at AX, I'm like, was that just inspired by Nasubi one-to-one? He's like, yeah, we were watching it at the time and said, hey, we should put this character in the show. And so quite literally, there was an animated facsimile of Nasubi in Infinite Revias.
Huh.
They weren't even trying to cover it up.
Don't remember that character. And that's one of those shows I'm pretty salty has been covered up by time.
That
but that's
one's
a whole
largely
other thing.
Been forgotten, yeah.
Like,
I think that show deserves an episode.
Yeah, all right. We'll put it on the pyre.
It's on the pyre.
Did we? Now, I'm trying to remember that the VHS for Nasubi, I guess as I go back and look at it in preparation for this episode, is a two-tape set.
Correct.
And did we get both tapes, or did we just get one? I don't remember.
No, we dubbed both onto one.
Okay.
One VHS. We recorded whatever it was SP mode to be able to fit the whole. I think each was 45 minutes or so. Mm-hmm.
It was
longer.
Half hour.
It's longer. I think it's like It's like 3 hours for totals. So
yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I
feel
rewatched
like
it.
It ended up I forget if you ended up showing it over multiple after hours or multiple dinner breaks or however it was, but I feel like it took more than one night.
It must have been multiple hours then.
But, yeah, so it's one of those things where I remember watching because it was such a stunning thing to watch and see, and, like, it wasn't translated or anything, and there's a lot of weird sayings and things and lots of stuff, but it's still easy enough to catch up on. But it was such a stunning thing to see and go, what the hell? And then it's also very different to see it at the time when, you know, I was calling myself 20, 21, some, maybe, probably not, maybe 22, that the oldest, and like seeing it there at that time of life and without any real context or anything. And just kind of being like, well, this is hilarious. Like, mm-hmm. What the heck? This is so insane and hilarious and, like,
absolutely
crazy.
Great TV. We were thinking, what genius thought of this concept?
Right? Yeah, right.
Like, yeah.
We're all thinking it. And maybe now is a great way to pivot into the reason why we bring this topic up tonight, which is a documentary released on Hulu this year called The Contestant. And it was, is it a British documentary? I believe it's
the filmmaker is British.
But it's made for Hulu. It's made for a Western audience. It's an English-speaking audience. And so it opens up with, you know, a pretty somber, you know, looking now 48-year-old Nasubi. And very soon after, the executive producer of that segment of Denpo Shonen, Toshio Tsuchiya, who is said genius that we were just talking about. And what I found very interesting was how now, you know, 20 plus years later, in 1998 and 2024, so what's that? Not quite 20, I guess it's, can I do math? That's...
You go 26 years by...
26... Is that right? Wow.
Don't do math of those things anymore.
Holy
it's
moly.
Not. It's not
so,
fun.
So many, many years later, where we have a much different lens, and we also kind of can look at hear it from the voice himself, the man himself, who experienced it all. Because what we failed to mention is everything we saw was edited for TV, right? They take all this dozens, hundreds of hours of footage they take in a week, and they even talked about it in the show. And then they have editors chop it up and submit it into a 8-minute segment for that week's Denpa Shonen. So we only see such a tiny snapshot of what Nasubi was doing every single day.
It was interesting to hear in the documentary how the director, because they didn't talk to a whole lot of people, which is actually one of my complaints, but one of the few people they did talk to was the director who basically edited all the... He had assistants edit the 24 hours of footage down to, like, 3 hours, and then he would take it and edit it down to, like, 5 or 10 minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And they even mentioned they had people's... The assistants and the directors, they had them rent the empty apartment next door to Nasubi so that early in the morning, they can sneak in while he's asleep, naked, and turn the camera on to catch the video of him waking up in the morning, right? So, you know, this incredible invasion of an individual's privacy, let alone his freedom.
Yeah.
It's well, also, I mean, it's,
so to speak.
Go ahead.
I kind of, aside from that, like, one of those things with this turning the camera on and off, it's such a crazy thing that, you know, if you thought about, like, the room and everything there, and these days you'd be like, oh, well, they could just have, like, a bunch of different little, like, iPhones or whatever, or, you know, GoPros sitting around. But it was literally, it was, like, one big, like, Sony camera that was sitting there, and then there was another one that was in the kitchen. And he had
the yellow composite cable.
Yeah, and he carried the microphone transponder, like, on him to capture the audio.
Yeah, like, when you consider this really was cutting-edge tech at the time, and it wasn't that good.
Yeah.
Definitely
although, I was kind of impressed at the footage they got for the documentary, the with the way they were able to clean it up. Like, I don't know if they just had, like, I don't know, Betamax tapes or something like that that was just, like, higher quality. Because, yeah. Or they just, like, did some really good old-fashioned cleanup. But some of that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, I agree. Considering I watched it on my 4K TV and it was watchable, which is quite the accomplishment.
That's a fair point. I didn't actually think about that because it didn't, you know, it's like good special effects. Like, you don't notice them. It's just like, oh yeah, of course it just looks like this. But you're like, no, it was like recorded and broadcast on, you know, old whatever 320 TVs when it was originally aired and everything for, so definitely not a VHS master.
No.
Yeah, late 90s, I mean, it was probably Digibeta at worst.
Yeah. Although being Japan, they were probably, at that time, you know, they were generally ahead in technology adoption.
Yeah, back in the late 90s, they definitely were. And I think that's, again, not to jump too far, but that's also goes to show in their web capabilities, because in 1998, they had a live streaming 24/7 camera on him with a dedicated staff of what looked like 12 people manning it.
They said 50, but I don't know if that was all the time, but yeah, it was.
Maybe it was rotating staff of like shifts. I can't imagine people can nonstop be monitoring him and not slip up, because they were also live censoring his nasabi.
Yeah.
His eggplant, which.
That was actually.
Yeah, I agree. It probably is where the emoji came from.
Yeah, that was.
I'm glad you guys brought that up. Because
I don't necessarily agree with that. I don't think he had that impact, because that came from. I'm pretty sure that came from the West, but maybe somebody's done the archaeology. But I feel like that's a bit of a leap.
I mean, it's sure the correlation is sure strong. That's for sure.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's just it's so well shaped. shall we say?
Ah, for sure. But going back to Tsuchiya, the head producer, what really surprised me was how candid he was about the whole process. Like, he was, first and foremost, he comes off as a hugely self-centered individual, in my opinion. But he also has vision, right? And not to, like, try to use a buzzword, but he basically heard, you know, the larger media say, oh, Denpa Shonen, that's that, you know, variety show that does those, like, travel segments, right? He's like, no, it's not about the traveling, it's about the people. And he wanted to prove a point, he even said it, he wanted to prove a point that it's not the traveling, it's the people that really make, you know, this sort of television interesting. And that's why, you know, he wanted to do an experiment of what happens when you take the travel out, you just have a room with the person, and what happens. And that's kind of what spurned the show, right?
One of the things on that, because I had watched the contestant and then I watched all 3.5 hours of the videos, because I definitely want to get to the third, the summer vacation video. and then I watched the contestant again with my wife, and she was like, well, wait, I thought this thing was about him living all this stuff, not just being so like completely like isolated and alone. But then it's like that Tsuchiya decided as part of it that, like, no, he shouldn't. It's not just him filling in the stuff. It's also about him being alone, because Tsuchiya was all about, you know, driving people to the edge of madness.
They're absolute, not necessarily just madness, but just push them to their maximum limits to see
what you can develop, what you can record.
And what they can become, right? And recording that moment. He was all about getting that moment, right?
Yeah.
And he never once, to his credit, he never once denied that what he did was hugely damaging to the individual on the other side of the camera. But what he was telling was what he did explain was his vision, his intent, and what he wanted to accomplish. Which, again, I was impressed with the level of candor he had, because I would say that, you know, most people in this day and age especially would instantly want to vilify that guy, because it's like you nearly drove an individual. I mean, Nasubi said it very bluntly, like, he was contemplating death constantly after a certain point. I think he said after like the first few weeks it started, that thought was progressively becoming more and more prevalent and forefront of his mind.
I think he was pretty vilified in the West in things that came out because
years later, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because he, I was reading the production notes for this thing, and one of the things they said it was really, he doesn't generally do interviews about this because he did some early on, and it led to, you know, the articles about this stuff, and he was basically portrayed as a monster, and he's like, I don't really like that, and that this the director for this kind of assured him that they just wanted to tell the story and not so much make him look bad.
Which I think they did accomplish. I think they were very fair in letting him, having him present his point of view, and then Nusubi, not necessarily counter, but not Nusubi also definitely was not, I mean, this is obviously, you know, many years later, but he didn't seem to hold any significant grudge toward Tsuchiya himself, at least not like a burning one. I think this is more of a just, of course, there will be a lifetime of some sort of resentment because obviously a huge amount of his mental trauma, you know, was.
I don't know if I agree with that, because they explicitly said that when Nusubi was trying to get money for one of his Everest expeditions, that, you know,
I was gonna wait to get to the segment, but
then he looked like he was gonna, like, it looked like, you know, he almost like wanted to kill Tsuchiya.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. For sure. I see what you're saying. When they first met after the, yeah. So yeah, maybe we can jump towards the end of the whole thing, but I think that's an interesting segment. This is obviously me projecting it, but I feel like Tsuchiya definitely at that point felt like he owed Nusubi something.
Yeah.
Right? I think that's something he sincerely felt, and he felt like, this is so important to Nusubi, I want to help him achieve this, the whole Everest thing. And I think that probably was a good way to at least stop the gaping wound from constantly bleeding for Nusubi, it was some kind of, right, like, olive branch from Tsuchiya, like, hey, let me help you out this time for real. And I think that probably helped, because at this point, I think Nusubi has gone through the bulk of his trauma and now is really trying to find purpose, right? Like, a lot of this is that Nusubi always struggled to find purpose.
I feel like his, Tsuchiya's, let's see, when was the Everest thing?
Well, so I was reading,
tried,
yeah,
three different times.
Yeah, so they, on the, in the documentary, they talk about, like, the one that he failed and got stuck out there trying to help Topal recover
from
there.
That was 2013.
But there was also aborted attempts in 2014, 2015, and then he finally succeeded in 2016.
Correct. He summited in 16.
And that was, and so he was raising the money when?
I don't know, so, for which one that was, whether that would have been,
okay,
like,
okay, I remember this. I just rewatched it as well. So the 2013 attempt, Nusubi funded it, used all of his savings to fund it himself, but he decided, hey, this is something I want to do for Fukushima, because this was 2 years post 311, and he is a Fukushima native, and he was this is the story behind why he did Everest, was he wanted to try to do something to make Fukushima stand out and do something to, you know, make Fukushima people proud, right? And mm-hmm. I'm going to summit Everest, and he is their native son. Like, when he went back to Fukushima after the earthquake and tsunami and was helping a community, it's like the entire community is like, oh my gosh, he came back to help us. Well, what, we know, that's so great. Like, he finally felt like he had a purpose. He was beloved by his, you know, the people in his hometown. And so he decided, I'm going to do this. And so he funded this 2013 expedition. Unfortunately, this was also in line with the earthquake in the Himalayas, which that footage of that avalanche that he survived was,
yeah, that was
terrifying. Yeah. I've never seen that before. I was like, holy F.
Yeah.
That is scary. He and his crew literally were filming an avalanche that buried them. They survived, fortunately. I think they were, their base camp was kind of at an angle that wasn't completely buried, but even within this base camp they were at, they said a couple of dozen people perished and several hundred were injured.
Yeah.
And so Nusubi then stayed in Tibet. His Sherpa had to leave because he had a prior engagement. Nusubi stayed in Tibet for weeks to help with the cleanup and rescue efforts. And again, he became, you know, this huge shining light for people who look at him. He's all this, you know, all this disaster around him, and he's still helping. But the thing was, he tapped out his entire life savings. So I believe it was for the follow-up expeditions. I don't recall which specific ones, but it might have been for 2016 when he finally succeeded. But that's when Tsuchiya reached out and said, hey, let me try to help you do some fundraising for this.
Because I was wondering when, because I think the This American Life episode about Nasubi was that 2014 or 2016? Trying to remember. But that one didn't portray Tsuchiya in the greatest light. They didn't outright say bad things, but I think the way it was kind of framed made him look pretty ruthless.
So it must have been for the last one, the 2016 one, that when he actually summoned it, because at least the footage I saw, it seemed like, again, obviously edited to look good for said documentary, but it looked to me, just the, you know, the way they were, the conversations they were having, and how, you know, the Tsuchiya's kind of general demeanor, I felt like there was definitely a very, you know, old Japanese man implied, like, hey, you know, I screwed up, let me try to help. And Nasubi being humble and say, hey, I appreciate the effort, you know, and he didn't outright just punch him in the face, which he was well within his rights to.
That's where I feel like I'm not that it isn't a genuine sentiment, but it feels a little bit like saving face, right? Like,
I don't disagree, for sure.
He's like, he's had all this bad press, basically, and this is kind of an opportunity to make himself look a little better. Although, also to his credit, he's pretty honest. Like, I know he does the whole thing about, like, oh, you know, I laid my life down for him. Well, maybe not, but I'd think about it. Like, you know, he's at least, like, he's not just lying to us all by saying, yeah, you know, he's...
Yeah, and again, that's what I was very respected, at least for respected about him for this, for in this lens of this documentary, was he felt very authentic in everything he was saying.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't trying to... I mean, I guess he was just... I mean, he was justifying it for the medium, but I don't think he ever denied the fact that it was at a cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He never denied that fact.
Say he doesn't come across as a monster, but he does come across as a somewhat amoral television producer.
Yeah, which obviously, you know, I mean, he even said, like, you know, because Nasubi said, when I first met him, I viewed him as some sort of deity, as a god, because, you know, he was like the super producer that made gold. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, later on in the documentary, she was like, I'm definitely more of a devil than a god. Like, he knew he was not a good person to, you know, have Nasubi do this.
Going into the show itself, I think, I don't know, Sam, I think you definitely watched all of it. I watched all of it. Mike or Nick, did you watch all 3.5 hours or not?
I did not rewatch it. I watched the little summer special.
The summer. Okay. So you watched the summer special. Okay. So it's one of those interesting things that at least that was crazy was that, so in the middle of it, and they cover it in the documentary too, where he has to move because something in the media figured out where he was living. And so they moved him somewhere else. Like, aside from that, it was like they literally just drove him around for like 12 hours, basically. And he got set up in the new place. First of all, like, when they set him up in there, they forgot his rice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They literally, like, forgot his rice. And then I forget if Tsuchiya or one of the assistant producers came by like a couple hours later and was like, hey, sorry, we forgot this in the truck.
Yeah, Tsuchiya did that.
And he was like, you can forget anything else. You just can't forget my rice.
Yeah, he was kind of upset. Like,
yeah, it's like, that's, well, your primary, I mean, food
not,
thing.
Not to interject, but I was reading an interview that Nasubi did earlier this year, like as early as recently as May, I believe. And in the interview, he said at his lowest, he dropped to 40 kilograms in weight. He was looking pretty emaciated, like especially when you see the cuts where they're going through it pretty quick. Like, you see quickly, like,
that's 88 freedom units for anybody who's
right. Freedom units.
So under 90 pounds for a man who is quite tall. I believe he's close to 6 feet tall. He is a tall individual.
Not short. Yeah,
and that's... yeah, they, you know, people that defend is, oh, they sent a doctor. Yes, this and that. But it's like, yeah, but I mean, is he technically alive? Yeah, but like literally the only sustenance he had was throughout the entire, fundamentally the entirety in the of the show in Japan, he basically had a bag of rice and some random things here and there, like the fruit, the fiber jelly, or you know, he got lucky one time with the steak and the lobster.
Yeah, he got that. He got some duck once, but when he moved to the second place, I don't know. It's like, I'm not a big like feng shui person, but I believe it there because, like, you know, they tried to tell him it was for luck, but it was really because they found his place out. But
right,
in watching a thing like you see, like he's still submitting like, call it 4,000 to 5,000 postcards a month, and it was over like a 6-week period or like a month and a half, or maybe it was like 2 months. He won like 3 things total. And like, he won like a couple of them were like, what was it? Basically the worthless like paper calendars that had like no monetary or food value. Mm-hmm. And he was like, even in the TV edit of it, even there, you're like, whoa, he is really losing it. And then they move him to a third location. And then it seems like he actually was submitting about the same number of things. It seems then like he started to win stuff again. So, you know, it's one of those things where you could, you know, toss it up to the randomness of statistical anomalies and everything there. But
so, this is kind of one of my disappointments about the documentary, which I have a few of them. And I kind of wish they asked more questions. To be clear, I realize that this show is not about the show, it's about Nasubi. But I was looking for a lot of information about like what actually happened during the show, right? Like, how did they ever help him at all? I think the documentary kind of says that they didn't.
They did go over things like for the first few at least weeks, they said they were giving him crackers because they realized if he died that would be really bad for the show. So they were off camera giving him, you know, like a packet of crackers to make sure he was getting something until he at least got his, you know, got some kind of food.
Right, until he got his first prize, basically. But which was good. That was one of the questions I wanted answered. Because obviously he wasn't winning anything at the start, so he had to have something. But like, did they deliver some fake prizes, right? Or like, one of the things I wondered was, he gets a TV at one point, and the TV gets no channels, and he's like, oh, there's no antenna or whatever. But, like, I kind of don't believe that's because of the antenna thing. And I wonder if they sabotaged it somehow because they didn't want him to see himself on TV.
I think I have some visibility there. My understanding is, in Japan, there's literally, at least back then, there was basically no such thing as free broadcast TV. You had to pay for TV service if you wanted TV, was my understanding. At least give me some justification. This is 15-year-old me over in Japan talking to my aunt. So my memory could be a little hazy, but I seem to recall her telling me that television in Japan is all, like, there's no such thing as, like, you just turn it on and it works. You have to have, like, some sort of service activator. So that actually can potentially be true. But Sam, to that, it also would make sense for them to not, I don't know how they would have sabotaged it, because I distinctly remember him winning the Densha to Go and being able to play it on that TV.
Yeah. I just wondering,
the TV,
like,
was functional.
Reception, right? Like, erect foil around his room, or like, I don't know.
Or
like,
they could have just cut the cable, you know, access to that particular room he was in.
Whatever. Totally doable. Because he gets a TV in Korea and it works fine.
Right, yeah, because we saw it, like, you see it in Korea, he has it, like, kind of on in the background, like, showing random stuff. That's a fair point, yeah. Like, was there any
I don't know. I don't see them having the foresight for that, but at the same time...
Yeah.
I'm
like 50-50.
I kind of get what you're saying. I think, but even if there were things like that, I'm sure nobody will, at least from the Denpa Shonen's, I don't ever talk about it, and I don't think Nasubi had visibility on any of this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's pretty clear. He was in the dark for
he knows nothing,
all of
sure.
this. He knows, yeah, I mean, the one thing I really did like about the documentary was they actually showed a small segment of him doing interviews after he finished, which was not in the specials. And that to me was super cool, especially because that BBC lady who was, you know, kind of like one of the, she was saying that the BBC, she was a correspondent there, and the BBC shared an office with the production studio for Denpo Shonen, so they were kind of in the same space. And so she was kind of, you know, very attuned to it. And one of the first kind of foreigners to really have a pretty, you know, deep insight and keen, like, see and I have access to Nasubi. And she even asked him, you know, she asked him very politely, you know, she asked him in a very almost like pity tone, like, how was your like mental state during all this? Like, she seemed legitimately concerned, which I believe she was. And, you know, Nasubi straight up just said, yeah, it was pretty much, you know, I was pretty much suicidal, like, all the time. He basically just said that outright. Like, he was, you know, had nothing. He had, at that point, I think also he was so desensitized to social norms because he hasn't had regular human contact for 15 months.
That was something I didn't really consider until I watched the documentary. It was like how he basically, it damaged him in social interactions. Some guy.
I mean, he couldn't comfortably wear clothes for several months.
Yeah,
what he said.
Yeah. He said he couldn't. He reported being hot and sweaty, wearing clothing for 6 months after the ordeal, and like had difficulty carrying conversations for like just a long time. Which.
And so that's kind of where I want. So people always like, oh, you know, if you know, yeah, this sucked for him, but like this made him so famous. Why didn't he take advantage of it? Well, if he couldn't have regular social decorum in private, how would you expect him to do that on TV where it's already even harder? So, you know, he was damaged. He was damaged for a long time.
Like, he said it pretty quickly in the documentary, but, you know, the show gave him the skills to survive the show, not to survive on TV in any other situation.
Bingo.
Yeah, it feels like. So, like, I go back and forth on this thing, and on the one hand, it's an extremely cruel experience, and he was taken advantage of. On the other hand, it's entirely voluntary, and to what degree do we allow people to control their own outcomes, right? Like, I don't know, because it was interesting to me that he did all this stuff. He never left. He could have walked out at any time. But, like, how much is he expecting that this will make him, you know, rich and famous, right?
I don't think he had that expectation because...
Yeah, I mean, from the sounds of it, they...
He was told from the beginning, like, most of this won't be aired, and he gullibly believed them, right? Like, sure. Obviously, his agent was saying, I think he's just...
But at the same time, I get where Sam's coming from, too, because it is kind of like, well, at the same time, like, yes, that's true, but he could have been, like, 2 weeks into this thing, doing this, and being like, you know what, this isn't being aired, like, I'm literally starting to starve to death, like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they also set him up to have him walk out be really hard because he's stark naked. And he even said that was one of the major hurdles, was like, I can't just walk out of this apartment naked.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean...
Especially in Japan.
It's true.
There was a lot of psychological barriers, yes.
Did he... Yeah, was it a gargantuan psychological... Absolutely, yes. I think the producers did everything possible to make him feel... like this was his only option, despite the fact that they also say he had a phone, he had his door was unlocked, he could have left whenever he want, but you guys also took his clothes from him.
And so, you know, the one time that he really tried to not go on, you off camera spent like 3 hours browbeating him until he said yes.
So I think this is a great time to segue, Mike. So he wins, right? He gets his million yen and he's, you know, Atsushi comes in and, you know, pops poppers in his face for, like, an uncomfortable amount of time.
I think that was the worst thing.
The worst thing was sending him to Korea and making him do it again. That was the worst thing.
Just as far as, like, a stunning thing of something, where, like, just think of that. Like, you're already crazed, like, starved to death, like, out of this, and then people come in and start just like literally just like shooting off fireworks in your face.
Yeah,
sure. Like, that's startling, but.
And then they just keep doing it in silence and being like, do you get it? Do you understand? It's like something out of Red Dragon.
It feels like a scene in a Stanley Kubrick film.
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick. Yeah, exactly.
Dehumanizing. Stanley Kubrick, it was super dehumanizing for sure. But for me, where really I think that left most impact was when he does this thing. He has a career, right, where he takes him to barbecue. They buy him kimchi. He gets on the amusement park, and then he's narrating. He's like, you know, back of the mind, I thinking this is probably not over. And then they blindfold him, take him to an apartment, and you see, you know, his slow headpan of the room and him kind of staring blankly, and Tsuchiya tells him, you're going to do this again now in Korea, and that look of extreme despair he had on his face that moment. And Tsuchiya was like, yeah, that's what I wanted to capture on film. That's when I really thought, gosh, this guy is a sociopath.
And at the same time, what we
see on television is, you know, a cut, right, a white pan, and then Nusubi's taking off his clothes, and he's like, all right, I'm going to do this till I can do it. And then you hear the story of it was really a 3-hour one-on-one negotiation between him and Tsuchiya.
And I don't feel like it was more of a negotiation. It was more of like a police interrogation.
Probably some gaslighting involved.
And that's probably the more cruel one, because it isn't like he can just get up and leave there.
Right.
Yeah, he's in Korea. He's in a foreign country. And they just they hadn't taken his clothes yet. But, I mean, it's pretty obvious at that point, like, what options does he have?
I mean,
because he still doesn't realize that he, in Japan, if he gets back home, he would be a very, very recognizable individual. That he still has no idea, right, that that's a thing.
Yeah.
I mean, how is that not human trafficking?
Right. Like you think about...
You took someone into another country and that they didn't know how to do anything, and you made them do something that they didn't want to do, that you wanted them to do, and you took away all of their means of escape. That's human trafficking.
Yeah. That's why I think that was the most horrific and inhumane thing they did to him at that point, because they made him really believe he achieved something, only to put another huge wall in front of him. Because now it's not just, hey, do this again for a little while. It's do this again in a foreign language that you do not speak for a plane ticket to get home. It's like, do this or you can't go home. Like, I can't fathom what his mental state was when he heard that.
I kind of want to know, like, I don't know. I'm interested in what they talked about. Like, how was he convinced to do this? Because it took 3 hours, apparently. And
yeah,
what was the pitch? Like, what got him to say, you know, yeah, okay, fine, I'll do this.
You know, that was the part in the documentary that I do wish they were, like, Nusubi and Tsuchiya both gave pretty brief summaries of how that conversation went. And I don't know, maybe Nusubi just didn't want to admit the things for, you know, his own mental health. But Tsuchiya made it seem more like, oh, he didn't just agree. I had to commit 3 hours to get him to complete this. Like, he made it sound like it was more of a his time investment versus, you know, Nusubi, you know, borderline thinking his life was over. Because at that point, Nusubi was saying, I thought my life was over here and that I was going to die here. Is what he said.
Like, I mean, this is my, I guess to finish my thought, this is another one of my complaints about the interview, is I reading through the production notes, the director didn't, they had a compassion for Nusubi in mind, which I think is good. However, like, I don't know, when you're trying to document something, I feel like pushing Nusubi more, they were probably held back some by their desire to not open up wounds too much, right? Like, and that may have led them to not poke at things that might have been useful to understand what happened.
You're saying the creators of the documentary were being a little bit gentle in this interview? Is that what you're maybe surmising?
Because
I you know, that could be it. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
I mean, it's certainly for Nusubi, right? Like, it's not a bad thing. And maybe it's cruel of me, but again, I kind of want to understand more about this. And actually, I think from an understanding standpoint of what he went through, I mean, I think this is even useful information. But I know I realize that part of these kinds of things in all of these reporting on things and interviewing subjects, you also don't want to push your luck because then they won't give you other stuff that you're interested in. So they're probably aware of that. You know, if I offend him too much that, or make him feel too bad, because part of them getting this him to agree to this documentary, because he'd been asked a lot for these kinds of things and he's turned them down because he didn't feel like they would put the right care into them. She had to get a lot of trust from him. He like spent, I think, like 2 weeks with her in London where they talked through a translator and they kind of built up that trust. I think there's some of that where there's kind of a sympathy and gentleness to it, which is fine. Yeah. Like, it's not wrong. It just means that there's some stuff in there that I wish was in there. Something that's not in there, but I wish was.
And, you know, this is just me, you know, projecting, but my guess is that at some point the producers and directors of this documentary are like, you know, we got about 80% of what we wanted, but honestly that's good enough, because if we try to push for the 100, he might end up
saying
screw it all and walking away, because Nasubi certainly doesn't need this documentary, right. One thing I've noticed now is looking at this, he seems to be very finally at peace with everything. I'm sure he's still battling a lot of demons, but I think the summiting Everest thing was this massive, you know, achievement for him that he's probably feels like he's achieved everything he wants to in life to be satisfied, and anything else is just, you know, icing on the cake for him. So he doesn't need this documentary, but the documentary people obviously need him.
I mean, I'm not sure I would go as far as to say I think he feels like he's accomplished everything he needs to do, but he certainly doesn't need the documentary. I would agree with that. I feel bad for him where he is in life. I mean, I hope he's genuinely happy. But it sucks so much to go from somebody who has fame and just can't leverage it.
Yeah. But I think he realized that it was, he finally found purpose in being back in Fukushima and, you know, helping the healing process there, right? I think even there was a line that Tsuchiya said, you know, a lot of people said that, you know, Nasubi saved Fukushima, but honestly, I think it was the people of Fukushima saving Nasubi, because they gave him that purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, he's, like Tsuchiya said, he hadn't seen that motivated of a Nasubi ever, was post 311, where he was over there, you know, volunteering, helping people, giving out food, doing free shows, right? Just trying to make people laugh.
Yeah,
because obviously it was a pretty dire situation, and you know he was committed to this cause.
Yeah.
For the first time.
I mean, in a you long can time. Tell in the Everest clip, right, when he's got that GoPro footage or whatever, where it's like the avalanche clears and he's instantly like, "All right, let's go help people. I'm gonna go sort this stuff out so people can find things." Like,
yeah, literally within seconds, he's like, "All right, I'm gonna put like food that's edible food in this pile. I'm gonna put like shoes and clothing in this pile."
Yeah.
So yeah, like it was, you know, like talk about being good in a crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
where did the what was her name, Hirakawa Ryoko posters? Where was that pile?
Yeah.
I don't remember if that was in the rest, but he submitted stuff. He got three different. Was that her name? It was something like that. But like he got like three different posters of the same. The same like favorite girl.
Gravure idol at the time.
Right? Yes.
Two posters and a calendar, I think it was.
Yeah, two posters and a calendar.
And then the faded energy drinks.
So speaking of human trafficking, I want to, because we're running out of time here, I want to go to a summer break. So they don't cover this at all in The Contestant, but in the show, even in the normal one, they show a little thing. They're like, "Oh, why does Anasubi look red? Oh, well, he was out on a summer break." But what it was horrible. It was Denpa Shonen continuing to be horrible, where they give him a supposed break, because this was in the middle of him being on the second location where he won like nothing for months. And they're like, "You know what? You've been locked up here. We're going to give you a summer break." But they take him out to this island, which I guess is the same island that one of the other Denpa Shonen people, they had to literally like live on and escape and make a raft to get to Tokyo. So they literally put him out there, and they're just like, "Oh, by the way, we'll leave you here with like your shoes." And like, they left him with a couple of things. It was like, a lighter, a can, one of his cans that he used to like cook everything in, and like some rice. And they're like, "All right, well, we're going now. You can have as much of a summer break as you want."
Yeah.
Which is just like, what the hell? And like, even there, he was so crazed that he was kind of able to survive. And the worst part is like, they come back and check on him. He's like, "Oh, I'll stay here longer." And he's like, "Oh, I just want to know, like, who's getting my packages while I'm gone for stuff I've won." And they're like, "Yeah, we didn't think about that. Also, no one's submitting anything for you, so this contest is going to keep going on."
Yeah.
And then he was just like, "Okay, I guess I have to go back now."
Yeah.
It was horrible. It's like, even in, that's one of the things, like, even in the edit for TV of that episode, you're just like, "Oh my god, this is just awful."
Yeah, like, when he's like tortured by the stuff left by Armenia, they're like crazy marking the days, and he's like,
"Yeah."
And his observation is kind of funny, like, "Oh, something, what was he says, like, something terrible happened here or whatever."
Yeah.
And it's like, "Well, yeah, kind of."
Yeah, because there were guys that were, they were on that island for like 4 months. It's
yeah, even when I watched that, because I watched that, I think I finished the whole thing, the whole Nasubi, the two tapes, and then I watched that, and it was like, by then you kind of have a feeling for his misery, right? And throughout all that, and so you watch that, and it's like, you see him having fun and stuff, but then when you see him getting freaked out, it's like, and then when they come later and they're like, "Oh, nobody's taking care of your stuff," you feel it. Yeah. You really feel it.
Yeah, because it's like, he's not given, that he feels like, "Oh, they've gifted me something, but really it's a cruel reminder that no, they really aren't. He's strictly content for them. He's not a person. Nobody's thinking about him."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a word. That was a word you didn't have at the time. But he was content.
Yeah. So many questions about this thing still.
He kind of feels like a prototype lolcow in some ways too.
No, I don't think so. Well, I don't know, maybe prototype, but maybe that's a very internet thing.
Yeah. It's hard because, I mean, he's happening right as this is starting to happen, as the internet is starting to make all sorts of things possible.
Yeah. There's a lot. Still so many questions about this thing. One of my meta commentary things about the documentary is, as I've kind of said a bunch of times, like, I have a lot of disappointments with this. Like, I had kind of hoped that it would be more going into detail about the show. And like I was saying earlier, it really is, and we've been discussing, it really is more about Nasubi. It's all about Nasubi, the man. But like, in a world of 5-hour YouTube documentaries about the Star Wars theme hotel, like, with every detail you could ever imagine, this is just so bereft of the details that I was kind of hoping to get, like, about how all these things work, like the human trafficking angle, right, in Korea. Like, how did they even get that? Did he have to get a visa to do that? Like, or is it like, did they secretly take him there? Like, just all these kind of logistical things. Like, why talk to more people, right? Like, they talked to one friend, some family members, the director and the producer, and like, there have to have been so many more people involved that it would be interesting to hear more about, like, that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I would have kind of liked to have heard something from the presenters who had to present the segment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what did they think in retrospect?
Yeah, that's one of the other things, is, like, watching the contestant. They have Fred Armisen do the voiceover of
He's not a voice actor.
The host, and like, he's fine, he does an okay job, but he is nowhere, like, the Japanese one is just like, it's such a different vibe.
Yeah,
it's so, like, it's so over the top, and like, oh, isn't this funny? And it's one of those things where, like, certainly watching it now, I think, even like, just watching the original, the clip show version, like, It actually, you know what? Like, even having watched the contestant, watching the Calypso version, like, it's kind of, it, like, it still was funny.
Oh, honestly. I still laughed. I totally.
Like, yeah, like, it's still funny. But I think it's one of those things, too, where, like, the longer you watch it in a stretch, the less funny it gets. It's mm-hmm. definitely better if you're, like, if you almost watch it, like, episode at a time and then come back the next day or the next week or something. Because if you watch it too much at a time, you're like, whoa, this is just getting
that
weird.
That goes to show that the editors and the producer definitely knew how to manipulate it to be appealing to the largest swath of audience possible, right?
Yeah.
And there was a segment in the short segment and documentary about, like, you know, how Nasubi was super, using today's vocabulary, viral amongst, you know, like 18 to 35 year olds.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually a segment that was largely reviled by Japan's elderly at the time, because these are people that were post-war survivors that knew real starvation and, you know, struggle. And they said, this isn't suitable television to show a young person struggling, naked, prancing around, you know, and because the only joy he has is when he wins dog food. Like, that's not okay, right? And, like, that was something that I found to be very poignant, was, you know, people that really understand situations like that at, like a real human level, mm-hmm. I think were like, this isn't okay.
Yeah.
And the producers, definitely being aware of that, again, edited it masterfully, in my opinion, to make it look like, oh yeah, he's having a grand old time. Look at how, you know, look at his dancing, his personality. Like, he's a born entertainer, right? That's what they're trying to show. I was like, look at this guy. He's naked in a room by himself, and he is able to enthrall a nation of people by himself, is what the story they're trying to tell was, right?
Yeah.
And they largely accomplish that.
And that gets to the final reveal when he returns home and everyone's sitting there cheering for him because they have this very different view of him. And then you literally just see him sitting there, like, with his hand. Yeah, his hand is just immobile. Like, and it's, yeah, the whole thing. It's
just that, why are they laughing?
Yeah.
I don't get it. Why are they laughing?
Why are they applauding, right?
It's one of these things where it's, yeah, I think from the perspective I've gotten here, I've been like, yeah, the documentary really wasn't on the show, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. Like, but it's one of these things where there's so much stuff and so much interesting things just almost in, like, the production and some of that sort of technical aspects of, like, hey, how did you guys actually manage and get an actual, like, live stream off of this? What, was it actually live? Was it delayed? Mm-hmm. How much, like, how was it doing? Yeah, was it going out at 10 frames a second? Like your servers were melting, I'm sure. Apparently, yeah. Also, apparently it was like a pay live stream too.
Yeah.
So it's like, how did you manage payments? Like,
how much?
Yeah, like all these, like, from the weird, obscure technical stuff to the other things, it's one of those things where it should not be as interesting as it is, and it still is.
It's a historic thing, like, good or bad. It's, you know, sure. It's like a war, yeah. Right? Like, it is a very historic moment.
For sure.
It's just, I wonder a lot about how that happened, like, what influence it had after, right? Like, what were the aftershocks felt throughout the industry? What happened to the show, which, goodness, I've seen it spelled Susunu so many different places. Where did that come from? Is that how they officially romanized their show?
Susunu Denpa Shonen.
Yeah, so Susunu, according to according to Wikipedia, and it reads, it's kind of like the Susunu is kind of a place, rather than like Susumu is like Susunu, like do not proceed.
I'm looking at the Japanese Wikipedia. It's Susume Denpa Shonen.
That says the predecessor of the show was called Susu. It says the predecessor of the show was called Susume Denpa Shonen.
Oh,
so the second one, they changed it from May to New. So, like, rather than go forward or onward, you know, like, and the Denpa Shonen apparently, at least according to U.S. Wikipedia, means kind of like.
Okay, I see it now.
It's a bunch of trays. It's kind of like crazy. So again, yeah, the first one was Susume. It was like, go forward, and the second one was Susunu. Like, don't go. Do not proceed. Go forward.
Okay. All right, that explains it. Those people were not stupid. It was just me. Like,
Yeah,
I mean, Japanese wordplay is not intrinsically easy to get.
Yeah, we were missing on all the...
No, I just was reading. Like, for subtleties. Some reason, it got it in my head. It was Mei, and Nu looks close enough.
Yeah, Nu and Mei are very similar in Hirokana.
Right, because we're also definitely much more used to reading Susume rather than Susanoo, which is such a weird little play on stuff.
All right. Well, we're already a little bit past time, but I think worthwhile for the topic. I think we've kind of had a pretty thorough conversation, but maybe any closing statements from the Kenzoku about anything related to Nasubi or the documentary that wasn't said already? Sam, why don't we start with you?
I have so many notes on this, but I'll just pick probably my favorite moment in the whole of Nasubi, the VHS set, is when he finally assembles the PlayStation Exodia. When he gets the PlayStation, and then he's finally got his Densha to go. He's got the TV, he's got the PlayStation, and then he plays it so long, and then he's like, "Oh no, I'm not filling out cards. I have to stop." And he bans it, and he's like, "Well, maybe not yet, just yet." And he keeps playing.
Yeah, then he picks it back up for another day.
Yeah,
literally a solid 24 hours more of Densha to go.
That was the funniest part for me. I was really happy for him when he did it. I was like, oh, you have the thing. You've got everything. Like when he got the VHS player and
Densha to Go back on PlayStation 1 back in 1998. That's like bleeding edge like gaming experience, like with the controller and everything. Oh man.
That was a red hot game. Like
oh yeah.
So yeah, that's my final thought.
Worthy final thought. What about you, Mike?
Well, I'm glad it wasn't me eating that dog food. It did not look delicious.
Fair. Very fair. What about you, Dylan?
We will have a post-project of going through, and it might take us a little while to get it done, but cataloging all the things that he sent in the postcards for, and then the entries. Some of them are pretty hilarious, some of the stuff that he sent things in. Sam did some cool capturing. There's a bunch of stuff where he'd send things in for, like a figure of, like, Lupin the Third, and a couple of other, like, random, like, anime hero figures. There was a Devilman one and a couple of other ones that he's like submitted a couple things for, so it'll be a project. It'll take us a while. We'll get it up there at some point. And it'll be great.
Oh yeah, I guess that's my real final thought, has always been that these contests must have a lot faster turnaround time than they do in the US, because you're not surviving on allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery.
So I started, just briefly, I started noticing at the first one, I stopped and looked at some of them, and then I noticed them. I think they take like 2 to 3 months from entry to delivery.
Which explains why it took so long to get his first prizes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
All right. And for me, I think as cruel as it sounds, I think one of the parts I chuckled most at was early in the documentary, you know, he was saying, you know, oh, I want to be an entertainer. I want to be an entertainer. His mom, you know, being a very traditional mom, and dad being a police officer, you know, she's like, okay, son, but please just do me one favor. Just please never take your clothes off. And quite literally, his first chance to do anything, and within a handful of hours of being selected for it, he is stark naked inside of an apartment by himself with the entirety of the nation watching him.
Yeah.
So it's like he broke that promise unknowingly, about as much as he possibly could have for the time. And the irony of that, I don't know. His mom just seems like such a sweet, you know, traditional, just, you know, mom that, you know, wanted the best for her son, and I could tell that this whole ordeal really damaged her, but that the healing is definitely, because when you see the footage of him going off to Everest for the last time, and, you know, his mom is there supporting him, mm-hmm. and she's, you know, she's tearing up, I was like, okay, that's cool to see that. I know it's safe to assume his dad is probably deceased. Doesn't surprise me, you know, Japanese men and law enforcement probably, or, not
Just didn't want anything to do with it, maybe, you know.
Yeah, could be. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked it up, but I'm assuming dad is deceased.
Yeah, it's probably safe.
You know, but mom is still being super supportive of him and, you know, still there for them. That was kind of, you know, seeing that kind of start to finish, you know, where he kind of literally breaks her heart and then seeing her, you know, support him. I thought that was pretty great. So, yeah, I'm glad that they made the contestant. I do agree with you, Sam. I think it's flawed for what I wanted to see, but I still feel like it's pretty cool that they were able to get Nasubi to be and Tsuya to be as candid as they were.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, one more thing. Nasubi, he looks pretty good these days. He's very handsome.
He's not a bad looking dude for a guy with an eggplant shaped head.
Yeah,
he's a pretty suave looking guy. He's grayed very, very nice.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Better than me.
Yeah, and all of us.
So yeah, that's it for tonight. Our next topic will be Junji Ito, specifically his manga. So you will have that to look forward to. But until then, this is AMO Kenzoku, signing off. Saraba.